Hello and welcome to Ribbon of Memes, a podcast where we interrogate films previously described by other deranged scientists as masterpieces. I am Nick, the reanimated corpse of the podcast, and I am joined as ever by Roger.
My goodness, I look stylish.
And we are talking about, well, our recent podcast on
Dr. Phibes.
Thank you.
That great surgeon and concert organist.
Yeah, you had many and varied interests. But it whetted our appetite for a bit of a British horror. We are going to be talking about not one, not two, but three possible masterpieces from the stable of Hammer Horror.
Yeah, and a little context to this. Hammer, the company, had been started in the 30s and had changed hands a few times.
Hammersmith, I think, where the guy who named it.
Hammersmith started. Gave the guy his stage name of somebody Hammer, and then he named the company after that. Which is going to be a pub quiz question one of these days. But anyway. So this incarnation, starting in the early 50s, had been making, for example, the Quatermass and the Pit. Or if you look at the Quatermass Experiment. Anyway, it's a Quatermass film.
Quatermass and the Pit is the last of the three, I believe.
Right, so it's the experiment they did first, with a great big X to hint that this was going to be a bit racy. and then Nigel Neal wouldn't play again, because they didn't like the way the character had been portrayed.
Well, they had an, without being rude to the actor whose name I've forgotten, they had an American actor imposed upon them, whereas Nigel Neal wrote him as a sort of a quintessentially British professor, and they had him imposed upon them because Hammer had an American distribution deal.
Yeah. But anyway, so they made another Quatermass film, but they took off the serial numbers.
Yes, that became X2 or something like that.
X the Unknown, I think.
Yes. I'm familiar with computer games.
and these made a bit of money, but you know, nothing really amazing. And they were burbling along, and so their next bright idea was, well, you know, everybody's seen the Universal Frankenstein films. Also,
which had been like 20 years before by this point.
Yeah. Also, Universal is very litigious, so we can't actually directly copy any of those elements. But we can make a new one based on the book. Loosely. I met a guy who'd read the book once in a pub. We were both drunk.
He was drunk. He told me the plot. The book we're talking about initially, at least, is Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, which was an early 1800s book that you've probably heard of.
Yeah, and they had exactly the right two people in the right positions for this. And so the first of these is Jimmy Sangster, who I think had basically been a production assistant or something of that sort. But he'd been involved in the practical side of filmmaking before he started working on this script. And by his account, at least, one of the reasons for the changes that he made, quite apart from we don't want Universal to be able to sue us, was we've got very limited budget filming resources.
So this was a script that had been doing the rounds a bit anyway, and he effectively completely rewrote it.
Oh, yeah, that's a separate thing. So, yeah, Milton Subotsky and Max Rosenberg wrote the first draft of the script, and they sold it to Hammer.
Interesting couple of characters who we may return to at some point.
We will definitely come back to them because, yeah, in an alternate universe, they might have been the Hammer scriptwriters. But
as it was, they founded Amicus.
Yeah, Hammer screwed them out of a percentage and just gave them a flat fee.
Yes.
Because they were desperate to sell, and Hammer had very little money and was trying to hang on to it. But then the film was a great success, spoiler. and so Subotsky and Rosenberg got very hacked off, and they eventually went on to found Amicus, which we've talked about probably before, and we'll certainly talk about again. So that's the script. Jimmy Sangster rewrote it very extensively. There is,
to the point where I don't think they get a credit either.
Yeah, I don't think they ever even thought about it very hard.
Right.
It is pretty much a complete rewrite. It may have some concepts in common. Yeah, concepts are cheap. But for example, everybody assumed that there would be the torch-wielding villagers mob scene. And Sangster said, you know, that sounds really expensive. So let's not do that. And it's a thing we'll be returning to in all three of these films, I think, because it does a very good job of looking like, you know, it's a perfectly good film. And then you say, hang on a minute, there are only two people in this scene. There should be a whole lot more.
So the film we're talking about currently, so this was the first of the Hammer.
Yeah, this is the first
Frankenstein
one, yeah.
Films.
The Curse of Frankenstein.
From 1957.
And the other guy is, the reason you don't notice there are only two people in the scene to start with is Terence Fisher directing.
Both he and Sangster directed and wrote all the films we're talking about, I believe.
Officially, Fisher's the director and Sangster wrote the scripts, but
yeah,
small company. So
yes, so this was a real shoestring budget, wasn't it, for Curse of Frankenstein?
Yeah, they had just bought. I think they'd just bought at this point Bray Studios. They suddenly had for the second film.
In the house of in a sort of an old manor house, or am I
yes, a very very decayed manor house, which was great from their point of view, A, because it was cheap, recurring theme, but also B, because when they had been shooting on locations before, they had often wanted to make significant changes to make a scene look better, and they couldn't do that in somebody else's house. But here they could just reconstruct, because they had to reconstruct anyway, it would fall down. So,
well, it leads to quite a distinctive sort of look to the Hammer films, I feel.
There are one or two places that start to look distinctly familiar, but we'll come back to that.
Yes.
So at the same time, Universal's Frankenstein films, I think, honestly, had made Frankenstein something of a joke, or at least Frankenstein's monster.
Had we got to the stage of, like, Abbott and Costello Meet the Wolfman? That we had, hadn't we?
Yeah.
Previous to this. So they'd gone through serious into parody, which actually, unfortunately, is a trajectory Hammer would follow 20,
yeah,
30 years later.
I mean, there is the basic thing. The guy gives his creation life and it doesn't go the way he wanted it to. You can't keep on retelling that story. What does Frankenstein's monster have apart from that? Not a whole lot. So basically, you couldn't really continue in the Universal tradition, but you could start again. And that's pretty much what they did.
Oh, of course, yes. The images were all copyrighted as well, so you couldn't make the monster look at all anything like the Universal ones.
Yeah, there were definitely lawyers from Universal poring over each frame to make sure that there was nothing that could be, yeah. So we should talk about the other two people who make up this trilogy of films, and frankly, I think they're great.
I'm not going to provide any criticism whatsoever to either of them.
And we meet one of them fairly early on in this, Peter Cushing. Oh my goodness,
Peter
this man
Cushing.
Is splendid.
He is, and he's really the leading man of all three of the films, to be honest.
Yes.
But he's, I don't know, something about... I find it hard to be objective in a way about Peter Cushing, because I just kind of grew up with him. Mm. And he's just, to me, the epitome of, I mean, he's not English in this, but an English stiff upper lip gentleman.
He might as well be.
Yes, exactly. I mean, the whole film is set in Karstadt or some German suburb, I believe.
Oh, we'll come back to this when we talk about Dracula, but yeah.
Okay, because it does get slightly confusing. But they are effectively Victorian Englishmen.
Yeah.
Or he is effectively a Victorian Englishman.
And... Well, I mean, we start off with him not being played by Peter Cushing, but the young Frankenstein is orphaned, and he now has all the family money, and he will indulge his obsession. But first of all, he will hire a tutor.
Yes. So Peter Cushing, it's an interesting role in that, I typically associate him with the spoilers to come, but the Van Helsing kind of crusader against darkness. But this, in one of his first ever leading roles, I think, but certainly his first leading role for Hammer.
He was mostly known as a TV actor. I don't think this is his first film role, but it's certainly a very early one for him.
Right. But he's an absolute shit in this. I mean, he thoroughly enjoys it. I mean, he's just... he's the classic mad scientist, which, of course, Victor Frankenstein often is. Now, in the book, he's a much more complex, nuanced, moral character, or at least has different problems with morality than the one we have here. But here he's just an out-and-out obsessed with... And again, it's not a particularly nuanced take of the character, but he's just obsessed with his science and creating life, and nothing will get in the way of that.
Yeah, I mean, obsession, I think, is absolutely the right word, because quite early on, he and Paul, the tutor, who becomes his friend as and partner in experiment as he's grown up.
Now, I've been reading a bit of Frankenstein recently because my son is reading classic horror fiction for school. Paul Kremp is actually in the book, but he's more of an inspiration for Victor than a direct player in the story.
But, you know, quite early on, they conduct an experiment, a small aside, there are not enough Wurmser's generators in film. those counter-rotating discs.
Yes, there's some lovely, weird science going on here, and some beautiful Erlenmeyer flask and chemistry action and bubbling. Oh, I know it's all nonsense, but it's beautiful nonsense.
Lots of dry ice involved as well. But, yeah, so... quite early on, they have killed living tissue, left it for a bit, and restored it to life. And, you know, that is, frankly, pretty impressive, as Paul points out. You know, at this point, Frankenstein could quite happily retire and never do anything again, and he would still be regarded as the greatest medic who ever lived.
Yeah.
But he just doesn't care.
He has other ideas. He's more interested in, Prometheus-style creating life, breathing life into flesh. So he's not interested in basically saving humanity from the curse of death, which he has done, but he is interested in creating new life. Obsessed with it, in fact.
Yeah, and it would be nice if we had some idea of where this obsession came from, and I don't think the film ever really deals with that, but, yeah.
Well, it's a pacey film, and again, unless, like, none of these films break 90 minutes, I don't think, or barely. They're all pretty fast-moving. And yes, in a modern film nowadays, and I don't think it's a bad idea, but some indication of why he's obsessed with this would be nice. But it is, on the other hand, it's Frankenstein. We know he's a crazy scientist, and we know he is going to become obsessed with this. So it just sort of cuts through that. It's not sort of a plot hole in the sense that there's no, you know, the acting is very clear what's going on. There's no, like, it's just we don't quite understand his obsession, and we're never told it. But
well, where I do think this slightly falls apart, perhaps, but maybe this is just me, his cousin, whom we saw very early in the flashback scene, but this whole thing is a flashback because we start off with him in prison, he's about to be executed, but anyway.
Yes, that's the framing device. He's confessing his sins to a priest.
But he
would argue.
His cousin turns up and is clearly expecting to marry him, and he hasn't bothered to tell Paul about this. But and on the one hand, it would work perfectly well if we just said, well, you know, he is so obsessed with the whole life creation thing that he has no interest in the marriage. He's just going to go along with it for the sake of form. That would be fine. But we also learn that he is happily screwing the maid. So,
yeah, he's quite a passionate gentleman, isn't he? Yeah.
Which, I mean, yes, it can happen. It seems a little odd. Partly, of course, this is because of the guiding principles of Hammer, which are frankly a bit lost on us in this degenerate modern age, which I might sum up as cleavage, fake blood, and Eastman colour. Both of these ladies are in low-cut dresses and frankly look pretty gorgeous, so, yeah.
Exactly. I mean, and unfortunately, that's what the women are here for in this film and all of these films. And Hammer is not a progressive studio. It's also, as an aside on the fake blood, it's quite a distinctive fake blood. It's very red. I mean, it's one of the first before this time, Blood was kind of hinted at, but not really shown directly on the screen, and Hammer was one of the first, maybe the first, to show kind of blood sprays and splatters and goriness. And probably the distinctive red is to make it more vivid, because we're still early-ish in the area of colour movies. That was part of the appeal of remaking these classic films, was to make them in Technicolor and have it all vivid and bursting with colour.
And a 30s horror film would not show you the eyeball that he's just obtained by dubious means and is planning to add to his creature, whereas this film does. And as I say, it's lost on us now, but this film was considered shocking when it came out.
Yes, it's tricky.
And it comes over to me, calibrated on modern films, as frankly quite mannered and reasonably pleasant, but absolutely not what they were intending.
Which is, I don't know if that's depressing or not, but certainly, yes, if they had access to, in fact, well, we can talk about Hammer as it is now, but they would have been right at the forefront of gore and splatteriness and torture porn and things like that. But as you say, now it seems quite genteel. It is not, I mean, frankly, from my perspective, it is not in the least bit scary, but it would have been at the time.
One of the aspects of this, of course, was that they were working in the UK. They knew what the British film censorship, and it was still called censorship in those days, I believe, regime was like in terms of horror. I.e. very damned, it's going to get an X just for being horror that isn't completely watered down. Therefore, let us go right to the far side of what we can get away with on an X.
Which is where we are.
Yeah.
And it is, I mean, it's gruesome, isn't it? There are some pretty graphic, I mean, Peter Cushing is so good at just, like the way he performs his surgery and just gets on with it and his expression. I don't know. He's just
casually wiping his hands on his dress clothes and then going down to socialise.
Yes. It's so, I don't know. I just find him massively watchable.
He's a shit, but he's a sympathetic shit, and that is a hard bar for me to get over, but it works.
Exactly. You're rooting for him because he's just so cool. I don't know what it is about. So we have Robert Urquhart as Paul Kremp, who is the kind of the as much as there is one, the sort of the moral guide of the film, or at least he's saying, hang on, no, we could actually cure death. Should we not stitch together a corpse and reanimate it? I mean, he goes along to a certain point, but he does have some red lines. And then...
Though we do have the whole thing of this is going to be the perfect creature.
Yeah.
Except.
It doesn't work out so well.
Fair point, it is Paul's fault.
It is Paul's fault. So in the pursuit of this obsession, like they find... they find a corpse, an executed highwayman who's been there, I think they say less than 3 days or something, who's been stuck in a gibbet. They cut him down, his head's not so good, so they take that off.
Well, also, not only a highwayman, but a highwayman who got caught is not going to have the perfect mind.
Exactly. But who does have the perfect mind? None other than Professor Bernstein, who was invited round for dinner and then murdered. Beautifully murdered as well. It's just really nicely done. Look out! As if... So he takes him to the top of the stairs and then says, look out! As he pushes him over the edge of the stairs, which I quite enjoy. How he knew he wasn't going to land on his head and destroy his brain, I don't know. I feel... Perhaps, like, we're being a little kind. If this was a film, frankly, if this was a film that either of us sort of disliked more, we'd probably be much ruder about a lot of these points. But I'm not going to be particularly rude. It's just, I just enjoyed it thoroughly from beginning to end.
I think some of it for me is it is not being a cheap imitation of something that is mounted badly. It is being its own thing. It's also sometimes mounted quite badly, but you can at least see, you know, they've got an idea here and they're going to do something with it.
Yes, I think you're right. The kind of blood and cleavage is the core of it. But it is not, to me, you know, those things pale next to our actors. So we talked about one of them, Peter Cushing, and Professor Bernstein takes his unfortunate fall, but he's got a lovely fresh brain, which is perfect for Frankenstein. He goes to get it out, whereupon Kramer smashes the glass jar that he's in Kremp, not Kramer. Kramer's Paul. From Airplane. Yeah. Paul smashes the glass, and so he gets lots of itty-bitty bits of glass in the brain, which doesn't do it any wonders, unfortunately.
But here we come to our second actor who, yeah, even if I hadn't known that, the creature is, of course, in a full-face mask. You have to. It's not the universal bolt neck thing, but it's actually a pretty good one.
He looks like someone who's had their head cut off and then stitched back on again.
But the only part that is really directly visible of the actor is his left eye, and I found myself saying, you know, I absolutely recognise that left eye.
It's very Christopher Lee, which is indeed who the actor is, and again, one of his early roles.
He was known at this point mostly for being a big guy.
He is a big guy. I mean, he's very tall. And Peter Cushing's not small, but he towers over Peter Cushing.
But I mean, nobody was really going to cast him in a dramatic role at this point.
No, you're right. I mean, I'm looking at images of him now, and there's not many people who can be recognisable under that amount of makeup with one eye, but it is indeed Christopher Lee, who he doesn't get so much to do here, unfortunately, but he is, I mean, his movements are, in so much as it's possible to play a reanimated flesh golem corpse type thing, he does it well, and again, he's not unsympathetic. I mean, obviously, the book, all the movie monsters up until, I guess, Kenneth Branagh's attempt, really didn't give the monster any kind of lines. I mean, the monster in the book is quite articulate, but in the films, he's usually just a murderous thug.
Yeah, I mean, the monster in the book could be regarded as a perfect innocent. So
yes, and in many ways, it's a fall from grace, and the story of that, and the story of what a terrible dad Victor Frankenstein is. A lot of the films don't touch on that. But here, Christopher Lee does get moments of sympathy. He does not
hurt by Frankenstein being not even evil, just completely amoral.
In the book, again, I mean, it's not really helpful to list all the deviations from the book, because it really just takes a few key facts from it. But in the book, Victor is horrified by what he's done and basically buggers off and leaves the monster on his own. That's not the case. Peter Cushing here, Victor Frankenstein in this film, is very happy with what he's created. He thinks it's great. It's not perfect, because it had bits of glass in its head, but nothing a bit of brain surgery won't fix. But it's Paul here that is the one who's horrified by what he's created.
Yeah, though I think that there's an interesting and perhaps accidental piece of character subtlety with Paul, because on the one hand he's saying, this is terrible, you must not continue with these experiments. On the other hand, he does essentially nothing to stop them. He will go away, but he will still come back when he's summoned. He will say, "Oh, all right, I'll help you out just this one time, but then you must destroy it."
One last time. Yes. He's obsessed in his own way, or such a good friend. He's fascinated by it, but he has got some pretense of a moral code, which makes him a much weaker character in a way than the much stronger Victor,
one could argue that Victor is not really aware of doing something wrong, whereas Paul definitely is, but he goes along with it anyway.
Yes, exactly. Victor is just all in, this is what I'm doing, and I have no hesitation whether it's right or wrong. That's not even a question. In many adaptations of the story, the monster escapes, and we have again loss of innocence scene where he accidentally kills someone without meaning to.
The impression I get here is it's mostly he turns up and just shambles along and in a vaguely neutral way as far as he's concerned. Somebody else starts screaming and he kills them to shut them up, possibly even by accident.
Yes, he's not really a malevolent... he's more of a sort of a force of nature. He's not really a malevolent force here. But then Victor turns up as they're hunting him, and Paul shoots the creature through the eye, which kills him. I mean, he's not immortal, this creature. He's not invulnerable.
And Victor did say that once we've killed the creature, that's what I want you for.
Yeah. Which he did. So unfortunately what that has effectively done is damaged the brain a bit more by putting a bullet in it this time. So Victor does it again. Oh,
who needs the prefrontal lobes anyway? So Victor keeps his promise to Paul.
See, also One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Keeps his promise to Paul, once we've made this experiment, we can kill the creature. And yes, now the creature is dead. He didn't say anything about reanimating it again afterwards.
Yeah, it turns out you can do it again. I don't know if there's a limit to what bits have to be left.
Well, sooner or later, there's not going to be any brain left.
No. The creature is in even less good shape. This is the sort of stage where you would expect the howling mob at the door. But that doesn't happen. I don't think you have more than four people on screen at any one time. Not that I can remember.
Pretty much. Somewhere along the way, the maid, who is Justine here, tries to blackmail Frankenstein.
Because he has, of course, been
promising her marriage, as traditionally one does in these situations. So I'm told. So.
But then, in a delightfully amoral fashion, he's just like, no, I was lying. Go away, shut up. He's not even apologetic.
Who's going to believe you against me? Yeah.
Yeah.
But when she seems likely to continue to make a fuss, he arranges for her to be locked into the room with the monster.
Who murders her.
Mm-hmm.
And then the film wraps up fairly quickly after that. We don't have a howling mob at the door. What triggers Paul? It's the wedding, is it? Or he realises he's going to, I can't quite remember what triggers the end scene of it. The problem with Frankenstein is I get mixed up with all the different adaptations. and the plot, in a way, doesn't matter so much, but it ends up with a confrontation on the rooftop between Paul and Victor and the monster.
And the monster has picked up Elizabeth along the way, because obviously you've got to do these things.
You've got to carry a screamer girl. The monster, does it burn to death then fall off the castle?
No, it is set on fire and then falls through a skylight into Chekhov's tank of extremely strong acid.
That's right, I'd forgotten. I thought it was water at first, because I hadn't missed it, but I'd forgotten it was acid.
They dispose of something earlier, but it's not made a big thing of. But this is how we get back to the frame story.
Yes, because within an hour there was nothing left of my creation.
Yeah, there is no monster left. So when the authorities get involved about all the murders, well, obviously Victor must have done it.
And Paul says he done it, and so does his wife. So he's a bit stuck. So poor old Victor goes to the chop. The guillotine, which is a funny method of execution in Germany in the 18th century, I believe. I don't know if Germany ever adopted the guillotine.
I don't know. I mean, depends on whether they were trying to be terribly modern or sticky with traditional headsman's axe or whatever. But anyway, Victor at this point thinks, well, obviously Paul will speak for me. And then discovers that, no, Paul, it was actually Paul what dobbed him in.
Yes. So he's hoisted by his own animated corpse, in a way. it's just a very watchable.
There's a secondary reading in here, because Elizabeth has been trying to talk with Victor and generally being brushed off, but we see a fair bit with Paul talking to Elizabeth, and I wonder whether some of his motivation, at least, is just a basic rivalry.
You could certainly read it that way, yes.
I don't think it's well supported, but I don't think it's inconsistent with the film either.
Well, in so much you can get subplots and nuance in this relatively short film.
But neither of them is going to speak up for him.
I mean, for me, it's hokum, it's silly. It has a distinctive look to me, the Hammer look. For me, having grown up, you know, Hammer to me is a word that doesn't sound right without the word horror after it. I just grew up thinking of Hammer horror film. It has a look to me that immediately sets me at ease. It's the lighting, the vividness of the colours, the staging, which is presumably Terence Fisher's, again, probably limited by budget. But
also they knew what film stock they were going to be using. They had the processing deal in place as part of the setup for production, and they knew what would pop on the Eastman colour process.
Right. Okay. So it's all quite a deliberately vivid, sort of hyper realistic almost. I don't know. That's not perhaps a bit dramatic, but it's very high contrast, vivid colours.
In an age when people are still releasing films in black and white as a regular thing.
Yeah, I mean, this is contemporaneous of, like, Sunset Boulevard, though, again, that was probably more self-consciously black and white. Mm. There is just something about, I'm not sure I'm being terribly objective, but something about Peter Cushing and the acting and the... It's horror, but it's not gone over into campy horror, to me, at least, like the Dr. Fibes films. It's very straight. It's quite serious. Everyone in the film is deadly earnest and very and really well acted.
It doesn't have the budget to distract you with special effects.
No. I mean, there are some great gruesome scenes, but to me, the film holds itself without... I know that's kind of what Hammer were doing, but the film just holds itself together in that it is... You care about what happens to Frank. I mean, you know where we end up. I'm just interested in the story. I know it's going to be silly, but it's not going to be like Airplane silly. It's not like people playing it straight with stupid things happening. It's just everything is true to itself. It's not campy horror. Not that I dislike campy horror, but this, to me, and Hammer did eventually... go that way, but here it's just deadly earnest. I just love it, and I don't know really what more to say, but I'm trying to explain why I love it, and maybe it's just my upbringing, but I just found it immensely watchable and enjoyable.
There is a connection to my early film and TV watching, but we'll come back to that in one of the later films. So this was a great success, basically.
I will just, as an aside, point out young Victor, I've just noticed, was played by Melvin Hayes, who British listeners may remember from It Ain't Artoff, Ain't Arf Ot Mum. So that was a surprise. Anyway, there we go. Carry on.
Well, yeah, this was the big break for the studio. It was very clear that this was making way more money than X the Unknown. And... basically, it redirected the whole approach of the company. Yeah, this is stuff we will do it more.
There's more films like this that we could revisit. There's more stories like this that we could revisit.
And so they immediately spun up a sequel, obviously, but we won't be talking about that today.
Though I have started watching it, and it's delightful. But yes, it's probably, I mean, the Hammer sequels all suffer from diminishing returns, unfortunately. But I am enjoying the sequel. Anyway, we move on to the other classic movie monster, the vampire Dracula, and specifically Horror of Dracula, that made the following year.
Yes, I don't know how the titles are. I have always known this one as Dracula. Brackets 1958
well.
If needed, but it was certainly also released as Horror of Dracula. It may have been in different markets or something of that sort.
I found it doing research as the Horror of Dracula, but I watched it as Dracula, and I think that's just it.
And if you know the story of Stoker's novel, you will be quite surprised by this.
Yes, again, it pays lip service to... I'm reading Dracula to my son currently. I'm constantly surprised how short... So Dracula is broadly a few different acts, and the first one is Jonathan Harker in the castle. That's five chapters out of like a 50-chapter book. I'm always surprised how short that bit is. That's probably why it's the best bit, because it's much more succinct.
But, so we open in a very conventional manner. You know, Harker, the estate agent, is arriving at the castle in the middle of nowhere, except now he's a librarian. He's specifically there to catalogue the
I think in the book he's actually a lawyer. acting on behalf.
Sorry, I think it's divergent because I have contempt for the character.
And Alan Moore, who treats him very badly in League of Extraordinary.
But the moment he's on his own, no, this man is a monster hunter.
Yes, he knows all about who Dracula is and what's going on.
It's not going to help, but...
No, it isn't.
And we've got a lovely castle set. Strangely modern set dressing. Those plasterwork pillars are not even slightly ancient, but it looks good.
It looks like a gloomy castle. I agree, perhaps not historically accurate. But here we have Christopher Lee back again, only without a ton of makeup, unable to just Christopher Lee it up.
Now, yeah, I mean, and this is probably his biggest, or certainly his biggest speaking part across the films, because in the others he doesn't speak at all.
Yes.
And one of the things that people mention is that, you know, for a Dracula film, there's not actually a whole lot of Dracula in it.
True.
And most of what he does is near the beginning, but while I was watching, I didn't notice, because his presence as a, you know, he's moving behind the scenes, he's doing sinister stuff, is always there, even when he's not on screen.
He's a towering, imposing thing, not just from his height. There is Christopher Lee's eyes, as we've talked about before, he can shine out through a layer of make. He's just very mesmerizing. Now, as a man, I perhaps had some problem. He was toweringly arrogant, immensely competent, and I didn't suffer fools gladly. That Lee, I think all of that comes through in his screen presence, that he is just this powerful, charismatic figure on screen.
This is one of those interpretations of Dracula things, but you know, certainly one valid interpretation is that his essential mindset is that of the medieval nobleman who fought off the Mongol hordes. Variants of lie, obviously. He tries to some extent to adapt to the modern world, but that is essentially the way he thinks. And there have been other interpretations as well, but I think that's what's going on here, at least.
Well, he's also, a beast underneath it. Though we don't see a lot of the kind of the kind of savage vampire side of Dracula here. We do see a bit of it, but he's much more, as you say, a nobleman, but with an older morality.
Meanwhile, Harker, the experienced vampire hunter, runs into another of the Count's guests, a young woman who says, essentially, help, help, he's keeping me here, you've got to promise to get me away. And this is odd, because he's behaving... The first time they meet, I think this is before we know he's a monster hunter and he's behaving in character. The second time they meet, we know he is a monster hunter. He should know what's going on here, or at least have a reasonable suspicion.
It feels like the film tries a bit to have its cake and eat it. It wants to pull this. I don't know whether this was thought of as a twist. You know, if everyone knew the story, I suppose they did a bit. But it just. Yes, I agree. He behaves very much like the Jonathan Harker in the book, i.e. a clueless idiot. But he isn't, or at least he's not supposed to be.
But in any case, he's even more of a clueless idiot because he manages to get bit.
He's not... Poor Jonathan Harker, everyone hates him. He was my hero when I was growing up reading Dracula. I must admit, he is a bit of a loser in a lot of the adaptations. He doesn't... it doesn't leave a lot of impression, does he, really, Jonathan? Because you're really there for Christopher Lee as Dracula. And
But Dracula tries to save him from Nameless Vampire Woman.
Yes.
And that hissing confrontation, I'm sorry to say, reminded me a lot of the way people used to LARP Vampire. May still do, for all I know. Yeah, but we can't actually hit each other because it's a LARP, but we will...
We can square up at each other. In the, yes, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't know, if Christopher Lee hissed at me in that fashion, I would back down. Partly because I know he was a skilled combatant in real life as well. But I would certainly back down from Christopher.
If this man wants me dead, they will never find the body.
He gives you that impression, partially because it's true, and partially he just has that intensity to him. He also, this is a slightly weird thing. One of the things that Hammer horror films brought to the role is kind of a sensuality, a sexuality to Dracula.
Mm.
I don't know if that just passes me. I can't see Christopher Lee as a sensuous character. It just doesn't, maybe because I grew up with it and it passed me by, but it doesn't really, I don't know. I've seen much sexier interpretations of Dracula. So while he's a handsome man and a tall, I keep saying tall, but he is quite tall, imposing figure, I mean, the sensuality is that the women sort of writhe around and wear low-cut dresses. So it's, you know.
Well, there is one particular scene later on where this is relevant, but we'll talk about that when we get to it.
Yes, yeah, I mean, that's Lucy later on, isn't it?
Dracula, Harker has done his primary job, which is to bring a photograph of his fiancée and therefore...
And can now be disposed of.
Therefore, Dracula is now obsessed with Mina.
Yes, so he goes to kill Dracula. It goes a bit tits up. He drops his stake. And that's the last we see of Jonathan for a little bit, because then we cut back to, again, the lovely Peter Cushing, but in his more, at least to my eye, the role I'm more familiar seeing, which is the Dr. Van Helsing alike. Here he is, actually, Dr. Van Helsing. And he is in... He's going to meet his friend. They already know each other, and they had planned to go and deal with Dracula. Jonathan Harker had gone on ahead. This seems to have been part of the plan. It seems like a terrible plan. But Peter Cushing is... or Dr. Van Helsing is now in the pub trying to find out where Jonathan Harker is and discovers that he's gone on to Castle Dracula, goes to Castle Dracula and finds out that Jonathan has been staked through the heart himself in a coffin. I don't think that means he was a vampire. I think that's just what Dracula did.
No. He has to do the staking himself.
Oh, yes, that's right, because he's been bit by the lady.
Yeah, because Sir Harker made the crucial error, the last mistake of his life. Having worked out where the crypt was, he staked the vampire Bint first rather than Dracula.
Yes, exactly. Bad move. That gave just enough time for the sun to go down and Dracula to pop up. So then we sort of... So he finds out that Dracula's gone and his mate is dead. And then we cut, as again in many adaptations do, to Mina. But here Mina is not Mina Harker. She's Mina Holmwood. And she's married to Arthur Holmwood, which I don't... I mean, this...
Oh, right, yes. Hang on. It's... Yeah, is it Lucy who's the fiancée?
Lucy was the fiancée of Dracula, of Jonathan Harker in this version. It gets very confusing, but I think it's Lucy who's the fiancée. Mina is in it, but she's married to Arthur. It's a bit... incestuous and weird, because all the names are there, but they've been mixed around a bit. In the book, of course, Mina Harker is Jonathan's fiance or wife. Are they married at that point?
They get married during the course of the book.
She's Mina Murray, I think, before then. Whereas Arthur is one of the people who proposes to Mina in the book, but doesn't get to marry her. And Lucy's just married...
Lucy
Westenra. Yeah, Lucy Westenra. I can't remember, but she is the one that is initially, as here, targeted and eventually killed by Dracula and turned.
But also, one of the things about Dracula, I think one of the revolutionary things about it when it was written, is that it's not just in a far country horrible things happen. It is bringing the horror right home to London.
Yes, and I mean this
film does not do that.
No,
Demeter is like... replaced by one shot of a carriage with a coffin in it.
yes. Well, fair enough. I mean, the book glosses over it a bit. There are adaptations that have done the Last Voyage of the Demeter and all that.
They don't talk about places very much, but the town in this case is Karlstadt, which is an actual town in Bavaria. And
not in Romania then.
But yeah, well, they do have to cross a border.
Oh, that's right. They do have to cross a border.
It was clear.
Border guard.
It was clear, I think, that they were never going to have the budget to mount Victoria in London anyway.
No.
And indeed, they don't even try.
Well, I mean,
one outdoor scene, and that's very obviously a studio set.
I know, but they're lovely studios. I normally don't like studio sets, but I do with Hammer. I don't know why. But again, it is effectively Victorian England, regardless of where. There's nothing Bavarian about the house that they're in particularly. Mm.
There is a lovely moment for Van Helsing here. Yeah, he's breaking the news to the family, and the maid goes off weeping. And he's got this expression, and Cushing does this beautifully, of, ah, grief. I am familiar with this concept.
As an aside to Cushing, there's a lovely moment in the Revenge of Frankenstein sequel when he causes Lionel Jeffries to have a heart attack and fall into a grave. And just, he picks his arm up to check whether he's dead. And then just his aside to the camera is just a beautiful expression of, like, what a moron. Anyway, he's just wonderful. But here he's got... So Lucy has taken ill. I forget whether Lucy's married to Arthur or Mina is married to Arthur. I think she might be Arthur's wife.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I can't remember what Mina actually does in this film. Not a lot.
Not much.
That's the short answer.
Well, Mina becomes the target of Dracula's obsession after he's killed Lucy.
That's right. So Lucy is taken ill. She's gone to bed. They don't know what's wrong. They call a doctor. He doesn't know what's wrong because it's Victorian Bavaria.
They finally allow Van Helsing to use his, frankly, strange methodology, and he fills a room with garlic, which promptly brings on an asthma attack, which, okay, we know it's because of the vampire, but...
Yes, the maid takes all the garlic out. But Van Helsing, Cushing gets this, which is traditional in all vampire films now, the bit where he explains, oh, this is what you think you know about vampires, but these are the actual rules in this particular film, which is they don't like garlic, sunlight can kill them, they don't see their reflection in mirrors, I don't think. And there was one that he says, oh, don't be silly, that's everyone thinks that, it's not true.
Well,
there's always a scene like that.
There is one specific point that about the transforming into animals, which Sangster said that he found this unrealistic and so left it out. I suspect the reality is Sangster said thought that it would be jolly expensive.
Yes, it would take Stan Winston and Rick Baker to do it properly, so... And they are not making... Well, they might be making movies at this film, but they're not pushing the boundaries of special effects like they would in The Howling and further on.
So, Terence Fisher's direction to Mina, which was written down, listen, you should imagine you've had one whale of a sexual night, the one of your whole sexual experience. Give me that in your face.
Okay. I'm not sure I got that. But it's a hard direction to follow, to be fair. Lucy dies, as she does in many adaptations, but is not truly dead. She is one of the undead.
I've written down somewhere along this point, the days before you could get your corpse actors to hold their breath.
I mean, it's hard to do, even in The Princess Bride, with poor Carrie Elwes being mostly dead. I can still detect some movement. We get some nice...
I do notice, I mean, there is a lot of staking here. They're very, very careful. You know, obviously, they can't show an actual stake piercing skin, but they can show the stake being lined up on the skin, and then cut to looking up, and then the hammer is coming down. Fair enough.
And then you get all blood bubbling. I mean, it is quite graphic.
I can't help notice, though, those stakes are going straight through the sternum.
Yeah, yeah. When you get people like staking themselves, that's flipping hard to do. I mean, after the first time, you'd have a pneumothorax. Anyway,
it's, I can't help feeling, particularly since it's meant to be a stake through the heart, you want to be slightly over to the left side at an upward angle to get through the ribs. And, yeah, that's much more
that
practical.
That would make it easy. I mean, if you went straight through the sternum, probably the splinters from it would pierce the heart, and it would do the job. But it seems like
you'd
not
have to
easy.
Put a lot of effort into it.
You would have. I mean, that's why you use a mallet, I guess. But I agree, going slightly to the side and up and in would be... what we're saying is a para-intercostal approach, which would make a lot more sense. Anyway, we have a lovely turn by the Undertaker, and Hammer's full of these little eccentric characters like the Border Guard here, or the Undertaker, who's just a little comic turn. He's never going to be in it again, but he gets to have fun. This isn't actually... is it Michael Ripper, the one who does most of these in other Hammer horror films and turns up in Curse of the Mummy? No, the Mummy is the one that isn't the Curse of or the Horror of. Anyway, but we have a lovely little turn by the Undertaker while they're trying to find the body, the basically Dracula's coffin, but it ain't there because...
Miles Mallison.
Is the funny Undertaker. Dracula's coffin is not there, but still they... stake out, ho-ho, the outside of the house to make sure Dracula can't get in. They've put garlic around the outside. Van Helsing and Arthur, who's Michael Goff, who I mainly know personally from later the Batman, the Tim Burton Batman films, but I've forgotten he was in here as a much younger person. Well, not as, he is just a much younger person at this point. But he still gets in and he still gets to Mina. And they don't know how until they realise that the coffin is actually in the basement of Mina's house, which is a bit of a faux pas.
But then he escapes and takes her and runs away.
Yes.
Good, because you know, here we're still more or less conforming to the book. He's got to...
We have, again, the final act of the book is sort of a chase scene back to Castle Dracula. Dracula's trying to get to safety. And again, it does, much smaller scale and much smaller cast. But yes, they chase him all the way back to Castle Dragon. Having finished, polished off Lucy, Van Helsing style. And he's very, it's quite a touching scene with Van Helsing with the little girl. That he, you know, he is a carer. He knows how to do caring. He's probably read it in a book, but he knows how to. He can be a reassuring, comforting presence. But then we have a very famous, I think, at least in my mind, very famous climactic scene where, I've forgotten what's happened to Arthur at this point. Has he been injured or hurt or, anyway, he's not in the final scene. It is a confrontation in Castle Dracula between Van Helsing and Dracula, as the sun is coming up. Heavy drapes are involved, which is not going to work out well for Dracula. At the last minute, Van Helsing pulls the curtain down, the sunlight streams onto Dracula, who then, well, melts and explodes. It is quite a good special effects sequence, I thought.
Yeah, one could argue that perhaps this fight is a bit fast and easy for Van Helsing, but no, I think it works.
I agree. Again, it's wrapped up quickly, but again, all these films are efficient in their time.
And I see a film connection which I didn't know when I saw the other film first. That whole thing with the dust and the ring is very Ming the Merciless in the Flash Gordon film.
I thought exactly that. I hadn't noticed that before. Because we saw all the dust disappear and the rings behind it that says the end, which is exactly what happens at the end of Flash Gordon, except Ming then picks it up again. It says question mark. But turns out it was the end, because there never were any other Flash Gordon films.
So there are things that work here. I think this may be the first time we have the Hammer classic shot of the moon with the clouds scudding across it,
yes.
Which makes me think of our Chien Andalou, but I don't know whether that was a deliberate thing or just here is a vaguely menacing thing to have.
It's effective anyway.
Yeah. I would like to see more of Lee in this because, frankly, I enjoy him playing Dracula, but...
Well,
again,
so did he, which is why he came back for many, many sequels, until they got ridiculous.
It's not a very close version of the book, but we talked about Murnau's Nosferatu in a previous Ribbon of Memes, and that is a pretty close version of the book.
That's so much closer to the book, yes. Yeah.
And there's the Todd Browning Bela Lugosi Universal Dracula, which we haven't rewatched for this, but again, it's a bit closer. As far as I'm concerned, you know, there is no need for a third relatively straight adaptation of the book. And as with Frankenstein, I like that they've got an idea of what they're going to do, even if that is simply hit the key points and do it cheaply.
I mean, it sets out the story of what it's trying to do with the opening scene, which is like I think it's a coffin, and then they spray a load of blood on the coffin. I mean, that's very much what they're trying to do with the film.
What one contemporary comment was, why should vampires be so much messier eaters than everybody else?
Because they're beasts. It's the inner beast. Well, no, because it makes more money if we spray Technicolor blood everywhere.
It is interesting. Lee is quite a long way down the bill here, but he and Cushing are definitely the people who do stuff in this film more
they
than
are.
Anybody
I
else.
Mean, they are Hammer for me, and it doesn't feel like a proper Hammer film, even though they crop up in quite a few of the Amicus films later, so they always feel a bit Hammery to me. But yeah, Peter Cushing... Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing carry the film again. Mm. I mean, Michael Goff, I'm afraid, fine actor though he is, he doesn't make much of an impression, nor frankly does anyone else in the film. But it's those two, it's the same staging, by which I mean it's the same feel to it. Part of the reason I find it interesting, a bit like Frankenstein, is it isn't the story of the book, so I don't immediately know what's going to happen. And so I'm interested. I want to see what they do with it.
I'm sure some people will be confused by the names being the same as the names in the book, or partly the same. But I think it's better to say, okay, you know, here we are aware of the book as a background. This is a new story. It just happens to share. I mean, lots of film adaptations do that anyway. So
yeah, I mean, this is particularly fascinating.
I would much rather see a film adaptation like this that tries to do something genuinely different than one that just does the book badly.
Yes, yeah, I mean, one that does the... to be honest, both Frankenstein and Dracula have fairly tedious parts to them, and so a completely faithful adaptation of both books would be, as later happened with Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula and Mary Shelley's Kenneth Branagh's Frankenstein, or whatever it was called, which are basically very faithful adaptations, and they're both good. I particularly like Kenneth Branagh's... the depiction of Victor, they go on a bit for what they are. They're a little on the pretentious side, and the Hammer films they're not pretentious. They know what they're trying to do. They do it really well, but equally it's not just cheap rubbish. It's not badly acted. It's not done without earnest. They were very lucky to get actors of the caliber of Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee.
And
they make the film for me alongside the screenplay. So let's move on to the final Hammer film today.
Just a quick note on set dressing and so on. I can't help remembering some more realistic films we've seen that are set in the period when these films were being made. Dance with a Stranger and Vera Drake.
Yeah.
Both of which are obviously trying to be distinctly downbeat, but that gives me my abiding impression of the aesthetic of 50s England, basically brown. and I think
with a bit of faded yellow.
Yeah, but I think what these films are trying to do to some extent is act against that and say, no, we've got bright splashy colour everywhere.
Well, this is, I guess it's in the dawn of the 60s, which does become a much more sort of vivid. But I agree, these don't feel like films of that period in a way. Right, let's move on to the film that was not based on a classic horror book.
By this time, Universal had come round enough to license the rest of their back catalogue to Hammer.
Yes, because they saw how much money the first two made. Because again, Dracula was phenomenally successful. So they'd done another one. They had done others as well. These aren't the only horror films Hammer did, but these are the kind of the classic three, if you like. And they're all the kind of the reflections of the Universal ones. By which I mean the final film, The Mummy, which is not, there never was a story of The Mummy in so much as there was it's kind of the rumour of The Mummy's curse, which doesn't really have any fact to back it up, but the discovery of Tutankhamun's tomb, and the curse that killed everyone.
This is actually based on three different Universal films. The plot of the characters mostly come from The Mummy's hand and The Mummy's tomb, and the climax comes from The Mummy's ghost.
Right.
So, obviously, they couldn't get away with that for the earlier films, but for this, yeah, they did have Universal on the side.
Some stuff. But we start off in, I think this is the late 19th century.
Yeah.
It's right at the height, or at the beginning of the height of the Egyptology craze, and we have Imperial, we do finally have actual Englishmen in this film, because everyone else has basically behaved like they were English, but here they are actual imperious Englishmen, behaving exactly as you would when you were stealing all the relics of another country. Mm-hmm. They have found the tomb. So we have the two older gentlemen who are, I've forgotten their names, the older professors, which are
Stephen and Joseph.
Stephen and Joseph, who have opened the tomb of an anchor, I think it is, from memory. Yep. A lost priestess from, there's not so much, there's no kind of Egyptian history to speak of, but from ancient Egypt, there's no kind of...
There is a bit later on, but it's not exactly history. The point is that there is a reason why this tomb appears to be in the middle of nowhere rather than, say, in the Valley of the Kings.
Yes, or the Queens, or wherever.
But we won't find that out till later. And I'm sure it's not at all because a pyramid would be really expensive to build.
Well, yeah, there's no pyramids in the Valley of the Kings. Anyway, it's fine. It's basically just a door it's like a sort of jungle area, or feels that way. But we have Peter Cushing again, again, a different sort of role. He's kind of the sympathetic, slightly innocent idiot. It's almost more like the Jonathan Harker role here.
Well, crucially, his character, who's the son of one of the two lead archaeologists, has a broken leg, and so can't be involved in the actual violation of the tomb.
Hmm.
There's a whole thing about, you know, you really ought to go and get that properly treated, because if it isn't, you're going to be walking with a limp for the rest of your life, which he is walking with a limp for the rest of the film.
He's
determined to be as on-site as he can be.
Yes, he's got his own obsession. Partly he's just following his father. Again, I'm super on board with this. I love the period. I love Egyptology. Again, obviously, we look at it in a different light in these days of understanding cultural appropriation and grave robbing, basically. But this is true to how the British and the French and the Germans and pretty much every other European behaved in Egypt at the time. In that these savages are not worth keeping this stuff. They don't understand what they've got. We'll take it back to civilized realms now, and we'll appreciate it more than they do.
I mean, to be fair, the argument against it may be made by the villain, but it's a perfectly good argument, and he makes it quite reasonably.
Yeah, we have another leading actor here, in a way, in that we have
George Pastel.
Now, please, was he blacked up for this? I'm guessing he wasn't.
A bit. Actually he was a Cypriot by birth. He was a favourite. We need somebody who looked vaguely ethnic. Giorgio Pastelidis, yeah. Perhaps.
I think his skin probably was darkened.
He was that sort of southern Mediterranean.
Yes, what you might have called swarthy in a racist way.
But they were quite happy to black him up a bit more.
So he
put him into ethnic type roles.
He has the patronising kind of. I represent the old country and you're meddling with things that you do not understand. And he is a long-time worshipper of, I've forgotten which priest, which god it is.
It is the god Karnak, who obviously doesn't exist in the Egyptian mythology.
Wasn't Karnak?
Karnak is the temple complex. The great...
But that's who they're worshipping.
Possibly seen George Pastel before.
Probably.
In two roles that he would do later. In the 60s, he got into spy films. He is the conductor on the Orient Express in From Russia with Love, a very small role.
Oh, well, I will have seen him, I don't remember him.
He is also Klieg in The Tomb of the Cybermen.
Well, again, I will have seen him, but don't quite remember him.
But that is what caused me to realise that I think it helps a lot to appreciate these films if, like me, you grew up watching old Doctor Who.
Yes, okay.
Because there's that same sense of, yes, this is not a fully realistic set or special effect or whatever, but you can clearly see what it is meant to imply.
Yes.
Like a stage production.
Well, that's it. You sort of go, there are some films where I just can't suspend my disbelief, but something, I totally agree with you there, something about it means you overlook the fact that it is obviously a film and you just go with the story. And probably because of our upbringings in this country, that just works for me. Anyway, it works fine.
Mm. I mean, similarly, one cannot help notice when the two elder archaeologists go into the tomb that they have just dynamited open, that there are lights on. One feels they would comment on that.
It's well lit, isn't it? I don't know if you're supposed to think they've been in there and lit some torches or what. I don't know. It's a very well lit, darkened tomb. Anyway, Stephen rushes out. Is it Stephen? Rushes out to tell. Oh no, not Stephen. The other one. He rushes out to tell John, the son, that they've got into the tomb and it's all fine, and he's just leaving his dad there for a bit just to enjoy the moment and enjoy getting murdered by the horrendous mummy that has broken out. Meanwhile,
I feel I should point out that as a tomb guardian plan, this doesn't work terribly well because it does rely on whoever breaks in picking up and reading from the scroll of life.
Now, he reads it out loud, doesn't he? Presumably that's what you need to do. I wasn't entirely clear whether you could just read it. That seems like a bit of a contingency to abandon hope, all ye who empty. And it's like setting your own trap and then jumping in it. But anyway, it does rely on it.
I feel that it would make much more sense. It wouldn't break the film if you just said, well, in this particular context, the trigger is interfering with the grave goods.
Yeah, I think there's fun to be had by him reading the scroll, but it is that classic horror film moment of what are you doing? Why would you do that? Anyway, he doesn't actually murder the elder professor. He just sort of pops out and woogers him to the point where the elder professor has a mental breakdown.
Fails his sanity check. Yeah.
Fails his sanity check in Call of Cthulhu terms. And then I think he just pops back in his little tomb for a bit the mummy does. And so
rather than say murdering the entire rest of the expedition, which would be a perfectly reasonable thing for him to do at this point.
It would. It'd be a much shorter film, to be fair. So then the dad gets shipped off to a sanatorium. I'm not sure quite how the mummy then gets out of the tomb. I think possibly our Egyptian friend.
So it's John who is left in charge of the expedition. His uncle being dead and his father being a babbling fool. And he clearly gets a whole bunch of stuff crated up and shipped back to England.
Oh, no, his uncle's not dead at this point. His uncle is still with him later on in the film.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But
nobody's died at this point.
No, true. They get stuff crated up and shipped back. They are not aware of the existence of the mummy.
Yeah, so because
it was concealed behind a secret door.
Yes, they've got the mummy of the princess, but the other mummy is hidden there. And at some point during that process, maybe just after they've moved out, I think before that though, that our Egyptian friend Mehmet goes in, I think somehow packages up the mummy and takes him out again.
Well,
then they dynamite the tomb closed because these bloody savages can't be allowed to get back into their own tomb.
Mehmet Bey has also taken the scroll of life.
He has, yes. Because the mummy is completely inactive again at this point and still can't do anything. Maybe he didn't finish. I wonder if he didn't finish the scroll of life, the mummy started moving, and then our older professor had his nervous breakdown and the mummy went back to sleep. Anyway, we cut back to England, the first time we've been in England in any of these films. And we are again in a lovely old manor house, of course we are. And again, it's only in retrospect. There's one scene where there's quite a few people in the whole film. There are more scenes, but I guess presumably they've got a bit bigger budget at this point. But there's more people at the campsite. And there's the scene in the traditional old English pub scene.
Struck me as very obviously the same pub room that they used in Dracula.
Yes, it is, yes. But it has some drunken idiots in it. We have comedy drunks again.
Here we have Michael Ripper as the poacher.
Where we have Michael Ripper. And we have is Pat, he's a drunken Irishman, I suspect. horrifyingly, in this film, if you're Irish, then you're generally a comedy drunk in a pub. And I think Pat might be. He might not be Irish. Certainly in Revenge of Frankenstein, there was a comedy Irishman.
Pat and Mike are played by Harold Goodwin and Dennis Shaw as drunken Irishmen, yeah.
But again, they have this. They get the fun kind of comedy roles of shipping the the coffin. So he hasn't brought that. So Mehmet has come to England and has hired bought a manor house just up the road from where the Bannings live. But he needs to ship the mummy over too, which he's done via FedEx or whatever, but unfortunately that involves Mike and Pat taking him across the fens. Presumably we're on sort of Norfolk kind of area here or something like that. I'm not sure.
There is a marsh anyway. Yeah,
there's a marshy bog thing.
I like the way that the comic relief is actually integrated into the plot, because one of the reasons things happen the way they do is that The drunken Irishmen find this crate a bit spooky, and so rather than taking time to secure it to their cart or drive slowly and carefully, they just go at top speed
as fast as they can, go over a bump, and off goes the mummy into the bog. He's remarkably unconcerned, his old Mehmet, that his stuff hasn't turned up.
Yeah, which is one of the nice touches. You know, in the morning we've got the police and John Banning, who's come down to see what's around because it's near him, and Mehmet Bey himself, who's using a false name here, but I can't remember what it is. And he seems remarkably, it was just some old relics, yeah, nothing important.
Yeah, it's fine. But presumably because he's already got the Scroll of Life, that would have been a pisser if that had gone. But then he comes back later at night and reads the scroll aloud. And then we have a return of our old friend Christopher Lee as the mummy. Again, a bit of a thankless role. He's good in it. I suppose he makes less of an impression here, partially because he's even more covered in goo and makeup and stuff.
Well, we were saying before about him having recognisable eyes. He has eye makeup here, which actually made it harder for me to spot, oh, yes, that is, of course, Christopher Lee.
Yes, I think I probably would have figured it out, but maybe more from context than just glancing at him. But he is indeed a walking mummy. He can't talk in this case because he's had his tongue cut out, as we find out later. But he is also a murderous swine.
We get the history at some point. And it's interesting because I think of the ancient Egyptian history as something that usually comes at the start of these films, but here it's more like halfway through, off the initial.
But he does that. So he's, as in a number of versions of this film, maybe all the versions of this film, he is the priest attending to, I think she's a female pharaoh. Did they have such a thing?
She's referred to as a princess, but.
Yes. And she has died. I think she's died young, but they were lovers.
Well, no, that's the thing. It's a forbidden love, and as far as we know, he's stuck with that. They may have been, you know, making eyes at each other or whatever, but that, I don't think they have transgressed the sacred taboo.
But once she's dead, all bets are off.
Yeah, they specifically said that the vows only last until death.
Yes, so he's all right then. So they build this tomb. She dies on the way back from somewhere, which is why they're like, all right, instead of taking her back to the valley or wherever we normally bury our princesses, we are going to build a tomb here. And then I'm going to kill every one of you so no one knows where it is, which may not have gone down terribly well, but that is unfortunately how things have happened historically. But then once she's successfully sealed up, put in the sarcophagus, then he pulls out the Scroll of Life. And he's going to perform the taboo. This is the taboo bit, is bringing her back to life. He's fine to do what he likes with her when she's dead, but the taboo bit is bringing her back. And he is caught in the act. He never does bring. Oh, she starts moving a bit, but then he's caught. And given his punishment of having his tongue cut out and being mummified alive in a secret door.
Well, given the procedure, it's not going to be mummified alive for very long.
Yeah, no, fair enough. I don't think they did the full kind of pull your brains out of your nose and put your heart in a canopic jar thing. But
it takes time.
Exactly, and they're in a hurry, so they just wrap him in bandages and stick him in a secret tube. Anyway, that is his story. But it turns out that the slight plot twist that they don't make a lot with here is that Peter Cushing's, is she wife at that point? The token female of the film, I'm afraid, who, again, doesn't have a lot to do, Isabel.
Yeah, she is his wife.
She's a slightly more feisty character than some of the other characters we've had. But she happens to be the spitting image of the long-dead princess.
Whose likeness is coincidentally recorded in a completely recognisable way in ancient scrolls.
Yes, exactly. Well, it's before they had cameras, so they had to... the Egyptians famously known for their photorealistic art. Actually, they were in later kingdoms, so it must have come from that kind of post-Christian era. Anyway, they don't go into that too much. But at this point, the mummy has already broken into the house and killed the uncle, has he?
He breaks into the sanatorium and kills the father.
Oh, kills
first.
The father, that's right. Does the uncle get killed? I can't remember.
Yeah, I think
there's
so.
Not a lot of murdering in this film, but there is a
Yeah, the basic approach is that the three leaders of the expedition must all die.
Yes. So the uncle does get killed. It can't be that memorable, because I cannot remember what happens to him.
But we get... they are country gentlemen. They have their hunting rifles and shotguns and things. They blaze away at the mummy to very little effect.
Yes, there's some nice kind of practical effects of Christopher Lee getting hit with rifle bullets and not being terribly worried. But just as he's about to finish the job and murder John, he spots Isabel and he's like, oh, she's the princess. And so he has to grab her and run off with her because that's got to happen in every one of these films.
I don't know whether there is a key moment that I feel is missing. In one shot, he is grabbing her. And the next time we see them, she is unconscious in his arms, and we never actually see her fainting. I mean, plausible that she would, but it seems
perhaps
odd not
just
to show
it.
She
wasn't a good enough fainter. I mean, there's not been a ton of of close-ups of women screaming in these films, so that's
true,
I guess. But there have been a bit, but not too many. Anyway, the mummy heads back over the moor to Mehmet's house.
Yeah, we should mention that there's a scene which falls oddly flat for me. Banning goes over to visit Mehmet.
Yes.
And each of them clearly knows that the other is the enemy, but neither of them is quite saying it.
So this scene, I think, in the hands of someone like Hitchcock or Tarantino, would have been crackling with tension. And it should be.
And both the actors could do it.
Yes.
Because we've seen them elsewhere, but somehow it just doesn't quite work.
You never quite... It just feels... Yeah, I agree. Flat is the way to put it. They're dancing with each other. Yeah, it should have been much better. But you never quite understand what John is doing there. Does he know more than he... I agree. Yeah, that is a good point. Well made.
But finally the mummy comes back to be... For the last murder. Mehmet is on site to control him because he's aware of this whole distraction potential. He doesn't stay far enough back.
No.
And it turns out the mummy is not actually bulletproof. He just has lots and lots of hit points.
Quite appropriate, yes. And we have a final scene over the moors, a chase scene over the moors.
During which he is carrying away Isabel, and she does get to do a few things. She gets to distract him and persuade him to put her down so that they can blaze away.
So that they can destroy him. And that's pretty much the end of the film. It's probably the lightest in plot, in a way. It's got the least for Christopher Lee to do, I think, and Peter Cushing's character is probably the least interesting of his portrayals here. So in many ways, it's probably the lesser film. I still love it, though. I mean,
the Egyptian sets I thought looked a bit naff, particularly the ancient Egyptian set. It's meant to be in a tent, but even so, it reminds me of the Atlantis sets in the Doctor Who story, The Time Monster.
Which is not
one of their better efforts. And of course, carefully implied nudity, but while never actually showing anything. Because this is the 50s.
Just about. This is 59, isn't it, by now? Well, there we have it. Three kind of echoes of the Universal films that we haven't touched. Are they masterpieces? For me, they are films that I could watch again, and I have been watching some more of the Hammer films. There are, and we may well revisit some other Hammer films in the future. Some of the different ones that are maybe better regarded, like The Devil Rides Out or something like that. Or that one on a train. Anyway, that's Amicus. Anyway. I find it hard to be objective about all of these films. They have got significant flaws. They are a bit silly, but they're never given a chance to seem silly. Because there's no camp in any of them.
Yeah.
And I feel like with these films, if you're prepared to go with them, they are brilliant. They're just a cracking run. If you think they're stupid and the sort of the staging from the outset puts you off, you probably won't like them that much. Though you'll probably still enjoy Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee regardless.
Yeah. And I would go on the basis that, when we say masterpiece, we are not saying it's perfect in every respect. These are clearly not perfect in every respect. Mm. But I had such a feeling of fun while watching them that I was prepared to forgive an awful lot.
Yeah, I think I'm going to allow all three of them in for me. For exactly the same reason. I thoroughly enjoyed them. I'm not 100% sure why, but they were certainly influential to the point where they kind of became victims of their own success because a lot of other films started doing it and graphic violence became
that's one of our other masterpiece criteria, that they were imitated widely, and they were first by Hammer, then by everybody else.
Then by everyone else, yes. And, graphic violence became more...
Well, particularly once they started making this stuff in the States where they didn't have the British censorship regime to think about.
Well, they had the Motion Picture Code, but that was dying at this point, wasn't it? By the time we get things like The Wild Bunch, where there's just blood everywhere and everyone gets sprayed with them, then it's pretty much dead, and then all bets are off, really. And then, frankly, when you've got a lot more money behind you, you can do this stuff more graphically and better framed. And so I think that's eventually what did for Hammer, which it's still going now.
Also, I think it's fair to say that the people in charge by the time the 70s came along, on the one hand, realized they needed to do something new and different rather than pumping out the same old stuff. But on the other hand, really weren't capable of thinking in terms of authorizing somebody to do something new and different. When Captain Kronos got made, for example, it was very, very much no. You've got this all wrong. You've got to have a proper conventional vampire film.
Mm.
So I will say, in the context of Captain Kronos, obviously these lose points for not having Caroline Monroe in them. But
yes,
on the positive side, she is 10 years old at this point. So.
So maybe we should be grateful for small mercies. They did descend into parody. Like by the end, Christopher Lee was vocally saying how much he hated the writing and the plots, and he was embarrassed to be in the films. I mean, I can't remember. One of them is actually called something very similar to Dracula Dead and Loving It. It's not actually called that, but that it's not too far removed from that. Anyway, that in their heyday, they were wonderful. And again, they're not, to me, at all scary, but I do feel, we're both role players. When we're doing horror role playing, this is the sort of thing I aspire to. This level of engagement from the characters and technicolor, just that feeling that I get from Hammer films is largely what I'm chasing when I run Call of Cthulhu, honestly, which is not at all what Lovecraft would have liked to hear.
One of the modes, at least, yeah.
Yeah, I know there's different ways of doing it, but that to me is... It's a big source of comfort in my life, that kind of feeling. It's odd because it's a horror film, but I just find them very comforting, very well done movies. I'm going to watch way more of them, having watched a few more.
Absolutely. And in conclusion, I would just like to say, There's something evil in there, Uncle Joe. I felt it.